America today, one family, the Walton family of Walmart, owns more wealth alone than the bottom 40% of the American people. And by the way, when we talk about the Walton family, the wealthiest family in America, and when we talk about Walmart, understand that Walmart is the major beneficiary of welfare in America. Isn't it weird that many of the people who work at Walmart are on Medicaid, which you pay for? They're on food stamps, which you pay for. They're in government-subsidized housing that you pay for, because the Walton family refuses to provide the wages and benefits their workers deserve.
Internalize profits and externalize the costs. They get to make all of the money, and you get to pay all the bills. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Fire You Can't Put Out, episode number 144. My name is Melvin. Hello. Thank you for being here. On today's episode, we are going to get into dark money. And then I want to finish off the hour by talking about a terrorist attack in Flint, Michigan. But first, let's start here. Ladies and gentlemen, you are on notice. Here comes the Bernie. It's been a while since I have gotten into Sanders or the Sanders campaign or how things are going. So I want to highlight a little bit of that at the beginning of this hour. We are still just under two weeks away from Iowa, probably about a week away by the time this episode gets out. And I want to start by talking about Bernie's policies and the highlighting inequality. So Walmart essentially started out as an American company, American-made, hiring Americans, all those things that we as Americans, we prefer, and we should certainly prefer. But as profit became the main motive, and I don't want to blame Walmart specifically, because it's not just them. See, Walmart took advantage of a system that was advantageous to them, and it was made available to them through lobbying, but they do get some blame for it because they did also lobby for the current system that we have. I'm doing it from memory, but I believe that the six Walmart heirs, and Sam Walton, the guy who started Walmart, died a long time ago, the six Walmart heirs have more money than I believe the lower half of America. Now, I'm not sure why that sounds like a good idea to anybody or why that makes sense. And they say, well, oh goodness gracious, Melvin, what's your solution? Perhaps you'd like to take their money. Their money. Is it their money if they're stealing labor? If all of the stuff that you find inside Walmart is made in China, is that not stolen labor? If you are not paying your employees here in the United States a living wage, is that not stolen labor? If you pay them that low wage with the belief that the taxpayers will just pick up their health care, pick up their food, and pick up their housing costs, is that not stolen labor? Do you not owe something to the country that has made your business possible? Yes. Yes, of course you do. But Melvin, look, if you start taxing them, they're going to take the jobs away. No, they're not, because here's the big secret. That's not so secret. They need you more than you need them. But they've promoted a belief system for some time that it's the old Ayn Rand idea of Atlas Shrugged, you know? The wealthy hold the world on their shoulders. And if you don't give them what they want, Atlas will shrug and the world will collapse. So 2 years ago, Walmart announced its intention to source an additional $250 billion worth of U.S.-made goods over the following decade, part of a campaign to improve its reputation as a corporate citizen. The Federal Trade Commission had an investigation going against Walmart and decided to drop that investigation because Walmart confirmed that they were lying about where their stuff was made. See, Walmart said that we're going to have more stuff made in America. And so they began putting Made in America logos on things. And as it turns out, those things were not made in America. The Federal Trade Commission was going to investigate them. They've decided to drop that investigation because they, Walmart, has said, okay, fine, we lied. What did you expect? We are Walmart. There is a sound business idea here with wanting to have things made in America. According to a Consumer Reports survey, it said that 80% of Americans prefer to buy things made in the USA. This past summer, a watchdog group, Truth in Advertising, said it found more than 100 examples labeled Made in the USA logo on Walmart's website that misled customers. At the time, a Walmart spokesperson told CBS that only a small percentage of items were mislabeled because of coding errors. Okay, so they lied, and they're not going to make things in America, but perhaps they are ready to start paying a living wage, seeing how they are all billionaires.
People in this country who work 40 hours a week deserve a living wage. Yeah. And workers in our city here and all over this country deserve the right to organize a union. In America today, what we are seeing is the richest people becoming richer and almost everybody else becoming poorer. Yeah. And what we are saying is enough is enough.
When you show up for your Walmart orientation, a couple of things may or may not strike you funny. They certainly struck me funny, and not that I have gone to an orientation, but I do know folks who have gone to these orientations. First of all, Walmart shows you an anti-union video. Now, what is Walmart's problem with unions? Walmart says you have the freedom to work, and they strip you of your freedom. The real problem with unions is the more unionized the workforce is, that means now remember, I said, they need you more than you need them. And if you unionize, you will realize that you, as the worker who makes all of those billions of dollars that they're making possible, you as the worker deserve a larger slice of the pie. And they can't have that because that will lead to social mobility, which will lead to chaos, which will lead to actual freedom. They can't have that either. They like the fact that you don't feel confident enough to go somewhere else and get a better job, because perhaps the biggest concern that gigantic corporations have with Obamacare, with the Affordable Care Act, is it allows you to move your insurance wherever you're going to go. To call the ACA socialism, or to say that it strips people of their freedom, or that it socializes the American medical system, or that it's a government takeover of Medicare, is BS. What it does is it insures more people, and it allows you to take your insurance with you so you don't have to be locked into your particular job. I don't think these folks know what the word socialism means. Our health insurance industry is still run by the private for-profit health insurance companies. That's not socialism. So, $15 an hour, which to me isn't really all that great. If you live in a place like Portland, Seattle, New York, $15 an hour still isn't going to cut it, but hey, you're closer than you were before. They say, well, we can't raise the wage. Why can't we raise the wage? Well, because the economy would collapse. Let's unravel this, shall we? Let's say that Walmart pays you $11 an hour, starvation wages, and whatever you're unable to pay for through Walmart, well, you have to go on the public system. If that's your food, if that's your housing, if that's your clothing, if that's your medical care, you go on the system that all the rest of us pay for. Walmart pays you $11 an hour, and then the rest of us cover the cost of everything else. So the system as it currently sits is unfair to you, but it is by no means collapsing America. It is, however, ensuring that these very wealthy companies get even wealthier. So the argument that's being made is that if Walmart has to pay the full cost for their employees, which $15 an hour, the full cost of their employees is going to cause them to cut employees, to kill jobs. It's a lie. It's not true. Making them cover the cost will cost them a little bit more money. and more than likely, you as the consumer won't cost you any more money. Because remember, the six Walmartaires are billionaires, and I know I'm singling them out, but they are a perfect example of the problem with this argument. So they say, well, what about small businesses? I've pointed this out before. Anytime I have worked for a small business, I have generally, with the exception of one government job that I had, I have generally made more money working for small businesses than I have for larger businesses. So let's kill a couple of myths. This is by Jeffrey Buchanan over at Oxfam America. Myth number one, Republican voters oppose a federal minimum wage increase, right? The Republican candidates, the Republican politicians, they've got the voters on their side. They've at least got the Republican voters on their side, right? No. When reporters discuss the federal minimum wage, the political context is often oversimplified, implying Republicans largely oppose an increase while Democrats all support one, but don't believe the storyline. According to polling by Oxfam America and GOP pollster John McLaughlin, it found that most Republicans, 77% in key battleground states, support one or more proposals to increase the federal minimum wage to $9, $10, $12, or $15 an hour, while most GOP voters support an increase. Unfortunately, most GOP candidates and members in Congress have yet to catch up. Now, the higher that increase went, the less people were, the less Republicans were inclined to support it, but they did all support it. Because remember, the low wages, they're not low Democratic wages. These low wages affect everybody, no matter what your political stripe is. So if you're a Democrat working at Walmart, $10 or $11 an hour. If you're a Republican, $10 or $11 an hour. And money means the same thing to all of us. If you're starving on that, then they're going to starve on that. Myth number two, Republican candidates who support a federal minimum wage can't win the nomination. Once again, Oxfam America, McLaughlin and Associates surveys of Iowa and New Hampshire GOP caucus and primary voters show that even among these very conservative electorates, a majority still support an increase in the minimum wage, 58% in Iowa and 59% in New Hampshire. Even among early state primary caucus voters who opposed an increase, most say they could still vote for a candidate who supports one. Myth number three, low-wage workers and their families won't be a powerful voting bloc in 2016. Oxfam America McLaughlin Associates poll found that 41% of voters, including 29% of GOP voters and 37% of independents, would benefit financially or know a family member who would benefit from a $12 an hour federal minimum wage, and almost universally support at least some increase in the federal minimum wage, particularly in swing states where winners are determined by small blocks of voters. Positions on the minimum wage could be a key to winning the presidency. Hello, Bernie.
It's called a rigged economy. And this is how it works. Most new wealth flows to the top 1%. It's a system held in place by corrupt politics, where Wall Street banks and billionaires buy elections. My campaign is powered by over a million small contributions. People like you who want to fight back. The truth is, you can't change a corrupt system by taking its money. I'm Bernie Sanders. I approve this message. Join us for real change.
That is one of the first ads released by the Bernie Sanders for President campaign. Now, when it comes to anything within the federal government, the largest roadblock to that progress is something called the Freedom Caucus. The Freedom Caucus. This used to be the Tea Party Caucus, but it is now called the Freedom Caucus. Because listen, you say Tea Party, you say, oh, conservative. You say freedom, it sounds like freedom. Who doesn't like freedom? And that's the messaging. This is Frank Luntz at his best. So, who's behind the Freedom Caucus? Here's what we know. We're not allowed to know. We're not allowed to know who's in it. We're not allowed to know how many members they have. And we're not allowed to know who's pulling their strings, which is who's funding them. Article over at Politico, Club for Growth and Koch nurtured the Freedom Caucus. The powerful outside forces, quoted from the article here, have helped nurture the political careers of 37 of the known members of the House Freedom Caucus, the GOP group that helped usher out Speaker John Boehner and thwart Kevin McCarthy's succession, according to Politico. Analysis done in conjunction with the nonprofit Center for Responsive Politics. The analysis shows that caucus members had strong support from industries like banking and auto dealerships that traditionally support Republican candidates. But the figures also demonstrate the influence of outside groups that have emerged as important forces in the Republican Party, sometimes colliding with its leadership over conservative principles. Doug Shadelbin, a Club for Growth spokesman, told Politico that the group does not blame the Freedom Caucus for recent leadership disruptions in the House. Quote, "Now listen to this. Our issue is not with the Freedom Caucus. We think they're being consistent with what they campaigned on and what their constituents want them to do. The Club for Growth and the Coke industries are the largest contributors. Those are the puppeteers for the Freedom Caucus." The quote is doing what their constituents want them to do. But who's in the group is a secret. You're not allowed to know. And if it's really freedom, how about the freedom of in telling us who the hell you guys are and what you want? The Freedom Caucus has shut down everything inside the government. These are the guys who won't let anything go through unless it benefits billionaires and big, wealthy multinational corporations. A name like the Freedom Caucus is nothing but marketing. What we have learned as large donors buy more and more of our politicians. And this isn't exactly scientific. I mean, this is just common sense. As more and more of these guys, these big dollar donors, buy our politicians, those politicians become less and less responsive to us. And that makes sense because no matter how much money you give Ted Cruz, no matter how much money you give Marco Rubio, no matter how much money you give Ben Carson, it doesn't matter. When they get there, they're not going to do what you want. And unfortunately, to some degree, this may go for Hillary as well. Hillary Clinton recently came out against Bernie Sanders, saying that he voted for these pro-gun bills, which is not true. There's a whole hell of a lot of nuance to that, but we're not going to get into it. But here is the truth. The largest seller of guns in the United States is Walmart. And Hillary Clinton was on their board of directors for 8 years. So what is it that the House Freedom Caucus wants? What is it that the conservative politicians want? Well, as with the progressive politicians, it's generally not what the voters actually want.
The question we're debating today could not be simpler. In a time of a $6 trillion national debt and a growing deficit, a recession and a war, do you provide hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks to the wealthiest 1% of the population, people with a minimum income of $375,000 a year, and in the process raid the Social Security Trust Fund and endanger that system? Further, do you cut back on Medicare and other important needs in order to make the richest people in this country even richer? Mr. Speaker, the answer is pretty obvious. According to an LA Times poll published yesterday, 81% of the American people think that the president's tax breaks should not go through if it means taking money out of Social Security. 81% of the American people believe that. I believe that, and I hope the United States Congress has the guts to stand up to the wealthy campaign contributors and believe it also.
Cuts are the answer. Cuts are always the answer, and cuts will always be the answer for the Republicans. We'll get to that in a little bit, but Speaker Paul Ryan comes in, new speaker, okay, Boehner out, Paul Ryan in, and the first thing that comes up is, the government is probably going to shut down again. Why? Because they can't pass a spending bill again. Now remember, they've spent the money. The House and Senate, the Republicans, they've spent the money. But now, when it comes time to pay the bills, they say, we don't want to pay the bills. Democrats say, you better pay the bills. And they say, well, then what are you going to give us? So, finally, a $1.1 trillion spending bill passes, okay? Do you remember the ACA bill? Okay. The American, Affordable Care Act bill, Obamacare bill. There were over 2,000 pages in that thing. And it became a thing of theater. Republican politicians would take it outside and shoot at it. And then they would print it out and they would walk around and they'd go, look how big this bill is. It's so massive. Can you believe it? Nobody knows what's in this thing. How can they do this to you? A 2,000 page bill. So. The $1.1 trillion spending bill was 2,009 pages in length. I don't see anybody, Republican or Democrat, on YouTube shooting at it or carrying it around and going, look at this monstrosity, because everybody got a little something that they wanted this time. The House and Senate are controlled by the Republicans, but they do need some Democratic votes in order to pass this thing. So they got to give the Democrats something. But what do the Republicans want? The Republicans wanted $622 billion in tax cuts. You know, the guys who said, we just want to make sure everything's paid for. $622 billion in tax cuts. And the cuts are permanent. The tax package, this according to Reuters, was a major victory for corporate lobbyists and Republicans. It makes permanent dozens of costly corporate tax breaks, such as the research and development tax credit that had until now been temporary. Middle class also benefit under the legislation. The bill offers aid to students, low-income parents, teachers, and others, attracting support from the White House and from House Democrats. Passage of the deal was helped by shrinking the deficit in recent years, which the president has been touting. He said, we've shrunk it by 75%. Can you give us something? But it is going to increase the deficit. Now, remember, the Republicans said, nothing that's going to increase the deficit. This is going to increase the deficit. The Congressional Joint Committee on Taxation estimated the tax provisions in the combined tax and spending deal would increase the U.S. budget deficits by around $680 billion. In 10 years, compared to just allowing those tax breaks to expire. Some Democrats criticize the bill, saying it gives more aid to large corporations and wealthy business owners than it does to working families. The largest and costliest component of the tax package is the Business Research and Development tax credit, the R&D, which will cost $113 billion over a decade in lost government revenues. Like the R&D credit, other business tax breaks would be made permanent, including one on business depreciation with a 10-year cost of $28 billion on active financing and lets business shelter profits overseas, costing $78 billion, and one on business expensing costing $77 billion. And then there's oil. We have had an oil export ban since the 70s because of an embargo. I was not alive during that time, but I was told that for a period there were very, very long gas lines and there was rationing of fuel. And so since the 70s, we have had an export ban on oil. Now, think back a little bit. Do you remember the Keystone XL pipeline? They told us that we need the Keystone XL pipeline because it's going to drop fuel prices, right? Drill, baby, drill. Drop fuel prices. Well, we began drilling more here at home, and fuel prices dropped. And then, of course, we struck a deal with Iran, and fuel prices drop again. Oil is now sitting around $27 a barrel, and we did not build the Keystone XL pipeline, which we are now being sued for because of NAFTA. According to NAFTA, the corporation that we were going to make the deal with to build the pipeline, which would have just shipped oil outside of the country, it was never going to stay here, folks. All it would have done was ship it out. Pipeline would have just moved it out of Texas, where it would have been refined and sent outside the country. And then that would have been it. It would have done nothing for gas prices. But in order to sell it to us, they said it's going to do something for gas prices. Well, we did something for gas prices. And we did something for gas prices without building that damn thing, which would have left us with all of the waste and none of the profit. Remember, externalize the profits and internalize the cost. You get to deal with the cost, or internalize profits, externalize cost. So we get to deal with the cost, but we don't get any of the benefit. But the Republicans said, we want to end the oil export ban. We would like to export oil. They finally said it out loud. We want to export oil. Fine. So as part of the bill, they said, Democrats, what do you want? Fine, we'll give you that if you give us some tax breaks and you end the oil export ban. So it is now legal to export
oil again.
And now the Republicans who say they're against the bailout, say they're against bailouts, are now asking for a bailout for Volkswagen. This, according to Melissa Cronin over at Gawker, Volkswagen was slapped in a Michigan district court on behalf of the EPA. And they're looking at penalties of around $19 billion. And so the Republicans have decided that they would like to, this according to the Fiscal Times, pass the Fairness in Class Action Litigation Act, also known as the VW bailout bill. And it's supposed to be voted on here in the House soon, and it would nullify the thousands of non-injury class action cases that have been filed by Volkswagen owners who are angry that they were lied to and that their costs, their cars have lost nearly all trade-in or resale value. Now remember, Volkswagen admitted it. Volkswagen admitted to lying. They admitted to putting these lying, cheating things inside the engine so that they wouldn't tell you exactly how much waste they were dumping into the environment. And the Republicans are saying, hey, remember, this isn't the working person we're talking about. This is a major multinational corporation, a billion-dollar corporation. We would like them to be bailed out, please. Thank you. Thank you very much. So how in the hell do we get to this? How do we get here? Dark money. Things happening under the table, things happening above the table. We get here because of dark money.
Tired of Republicans and Democrats who either want Republicans who want to burn the place to the ground and Democrats, with all due respect, who want to offer a plan that gets it through the their end of their second term of their presidency and then screws me and my kids when it's over. And until we do that, we have to deal with the extraction that is at foot. It is the reason the financial markets are behaving the way they're behaving. That is a mathematical fact. This is not some opinion. This is a mathematical fact. Tens of trillions of dollars are being extracted from the United States of America. Democrats aren't doing it. Republicans are not doing it. An entire integrated system, financial system, trading system, taxing system that was created by both parties over a period of two decades is at work on our entire country right now. And we're sitting here arguing about whether we should do the $4 trillion plan that kicks the can down the road for the president for 2017 or burn the place to the ground, both of which are reckless, irresponsible, and stupid.
The Citizens United decision in 2010 is essentially what brought us to where we're at right now. And it said that you, as a corporation, can put together a super PAC and support any candidate with as much money as you want because money is speech. And it essentially put all of our elections up for sale. But it said, remember, you got to do it through the super PAC. You cannot directly fundraise with or even communicate with the candidate themselves. So the headline, this from truthout.org, notable conservatives have been tied to a nonprofit scofflaw. This is after an investigation by the Federal Election Commission. Those involved with the Commission for Hope, Growth, and Opportunity Group include William Canfield, General Counsel for the Pro Carly Fiorina PAC Carly for America, Scott Reed, a senior political strategist for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and Wayne Berman, a senior advisor at Blackstone, who serves as a presidential candidate Marco Rubio's national finance chairman. Within the 227 pages of the FEC legal documents released after a five-year investigation, the three men are characterized as being part of a decision-making core behind the law-breaking nonprofit's decidedly political activities. There are six members in the FEC right now. Three Republicans, three Democrats, and they are deadlocked on this issue. They say, the three Democrats say, yes, this was illegal. And the three Republicans say, no, this was not illegal. Deadlocked. So now, what are we going to do? Clearly, these groups have been interacting directly with their campaigns. It's an open secret more than it's anything. Now remember, super PACs are not the campaigns. They don't work for the campaigns. They work for the favor of the campaigns, but they're not supposed to work directly with the campaigns. But what happened here is, at the very least, these three were working directly with campaigns, and the FEC says, no, that is illegal. So what are we going to do? Heads have to roll, right? Somebody has to be in trouble for this. But there's a deadlock at the FEC. So what are we going to do? The headline, Happy Holidays, Super PACs. The FEC removes yet another block against dark money. The Federal Election Commission has quietly released a new advisory opinion that will make it even easier for candidates and their staffers to solicit Super PAC donations. The opinion states that candidates can ask for funds from donors as long as they are meeting in small groups, as small as three people. According to the Washington Post, which first reported on the story, in addition, campaign staffers and consultants will be allowed to solicit large donations for super PACs as long as they make it clear that they're not directed to do so by the candidate. Gold continues, excuse me, Matea Gold from the Post, federal candidates are still not permitted to explicitly ask a donor to give more than $5,000 to a super PAC. But the latest decision means that an elected official or a candidate can meet privately with just one wealthy donor and one super PAC operative to discuss fundraising for the group. One of the two Democrats on the six-member panel who opposed loosening the rules was Ellen Weintraub. All that is required under the guidelines is a written invitation, a formal program, and a disclaimer that the candidate is appearing as a special guest who is not soliciting large checks. The new rules further blur the lines between the candidate seeking public office and the private entities that fund their election campaigns, removing yet more safeguards against political malfeasance and raising new transparency concerns.
Money in politics is the root of all political evil. It is corruption at its worst. And until we step up and kick that out of the park, it's going to be the same system.
I have to ask you, ladies and gentlemen, have you heard anything about this? Am I the first person to tell you about this? The FEC's opinion, this according to the article, largely unnoticed since it was offered in November, comes after years of criticism from throughout the progressive sphere over the agency's weak enforcement of campaign finance rules that have become precious since the Supreme Court in 2010 ruled in favor of corporate dark money in Citizens v. FEC. In October, a coalition of activists and organizations released a letter slamming the agency's weak enforcement of those rules, calling on the commissioners to simply do their jobs. That clip that I played at the beginning of this segment, where that guy was freaking out, and it wasn't partisan. He's not freaking out on one party. He's freaking out on both of them. He's freaking out on the whole establishment. He's saying, look, listen, none of us are being served by this system. So what can we do now? Well, let me tell you this. The Supreme Court made this decision. The Supreme Court, namely this Supreme Court, writes laws out of whole cloth. They just make their own laws up now. They are more powerful than the House and the Senate and the presidency, and there's only 9 members. So as long as they have 5, they have all the conservative rulings that they want. So what do we do? Melvin, perhaps we should vote for a Republican, clearly, because this happened during a Democratic administration. No. That's not the way this works. The Supreme Court is picked by the president, but it's confirmed by the House and Senate. George W. Bush picked 2 members. Yes, Barack Obama picked 2 members also, but he replaced 2 progressive members with 2 more progressive members. George W. Bush took somebody conservative, put somebody even more conservative, and then took somebody that was a swing vote and put somebody super conservative. So now we've got a 5-4 decision. If we have a Republican president after this election cycle, the 2016 election cycle, which, by the way, is expected to cost $10 billion now. Think about that. We don't even get our money's worth with how much money that we're spending on elections. If we get another Republican, it could make that 6, 7, 8, or even 9 hardcore conservatives. And those folks serve for life. And George W. Bush did it right. He put young guys on the court, knowing that they're going to be there for a long, long, long time. And this is one of the reasons that you have such an anti-establishment movement this year in politics because everybody's sick of it. Everybody's frustrated. On the left, you've got people getting behind Bernie Sanders. And on the right, they're getting behind Donald Trump.
Even if you're not feeling good, if you're feeling horrible, if you had a horrible fight with your wife or your husband, if you caught your husband cheating the night before, you've got to go to the caucus. Right? Right? And vice versa.
Donald Trump says he doesn't care what it takes. You better get out there and you better vote for him. And he's saying ISIS is coming and the end of America is coming and high taxes and all this bad stuff. If you don't vote for me, if you don't come out for me, bad things are going to happen to you. Donald Trump. This is an article from Alternet, and it's well-sourced. It's got about 40 different footnotes in it. And the headline is, Donald Trump talks at a fourth grade level. Maybe that's why the Fox News audience loves him. This according to, an article over at Salon. It's a cliche to say that Democratic states can't properly function without an informed electorate. But it's also absolutely true. But Trump isn't the cause, just the symptom. The deeper cause is a strain of anti-intellectualism that runs through the roots of American culture. And while this strain is found on both sides of the political spectrum, see some liberals on vaccines, it's mostly concentrated among religious conservatives on the political right. For those who espouse anti-intellectual conspiracy theories have the same clout as legitimate science does. The opinions of non-experts are just as credible as those of experts. And ideology takes precedence over cold, hard facts. The U.S. has fostered a culture of anti-intellectualism more than most other Western countries. This according to Psychology Today. In the U.K., it's generally not seen as uncool to have a higher degree from a good university. Often, it confers that the degree holder a certain social respect and admiration. Many of the top comedians in the UK have attended institutions like Oxford and Cambridge, including Michael Palin, Eric Idle, John Cleese, David Mitchell, Richard Ayoade, and Stephen Fry. And shows as much as, there's a show called QI, which combines academic discussions with uproarious, irreverent humor and popular hits. Not only is the U.S. unique in its love affair for anti-intellectualism, but this romantic relationship appears to have grown stronger over the past few decades. A primary reason for this is no doubt the huge influence the conservative media have had on American culture. Fox News, which is currently, quote, the most trusted news network in the country, is a problem. Fox News viewership constitutes the most misinformed audience that's out there. This according to Alternet. There's a study that's done every year. If you turn into conservative programming, whether it be radio or television or written, they will often make fun of what they call academia. And that is saying smart people. Smart people are the problem, okay? Because they're not regular like us. They're not down home like us. And there's a study that's reconfirmed every year, and it talks with people about what they know about the news. And in every year, it's the same result. Those who watch Fox News are less informed than those who watch no news whatsoever. No news! You're more informed if you watch no news whatsoever than you are if you watch Fox. From climate change to healthcare, the Iraq war, to the country of Obama's birth, which conservatives believe is Kenya, denizens of Fox News are more confident about their falsehoods than viewers of any other news networks. Several studies even found a positive correlation between how often one watches Fox News and the degree to which their worldview is misinformed. The most dangerous consequence of Fox News is that it discourages the most important form of rigorous curiosity called critical thinking. If people want a single phenomenon to blame for the gradual decline of American empire, direct your wagging finger at the devaluation of critical thinking skills. Critical thinking is perhaps our very best strategy for apprehending the true nature of reality. In other words, critical thinking could lead to liberalism or worse, to that most dreaded form of liberal fanaticism called secular progressivism. Scientific studies actually back up this line of reasoning. Consider a 2012 study published in Science, one of the most prestigious journals in the world. The study found that when people are prompted to use their critical faculties, they become less likely to affirm religious statements. In other words, there's a causal link between analytical thinking and religious disbelief. Perhaps this is why the Republican Party of Texas literally wrote into its 2012 platform that, quote, "We oppose the teaching of higher order thinking skills, HOTS, critical thinking skills, and similar programs that have the purpose of challenging these students' fixed beliefs." Another peer-reviewed paper found that people who think deliberately and effortfully about certain topics tend to express more liberal views. As the authors put it, political conservatism may be a consequence of low effort thought. Multiple studies have reported that liberals and atheists have higher average IQs than conservatives. One study even found that low childhood IQ predicts conservative and racist beliefs later in life. The point is that when a large portion of the electorate is fooled into adopting an ideology of ignorance, spaces open up for charlatans, frauds, and demagogues to gain political power over the masses. This is precisely what we've seen with the rise of Trump, and why he's a symptom of the disease rather than the cause. According to a recent poll, Trump's support base consists of the least educated Americans. As a Washington Post article put it, even when pollsters took race out of the equation, to the extent that it is possible, since the Republican base is overwhelmingly white, and looked at all Republicans, the relationship between education and Trump support was pretty clear. The conclusion is consistent with a Boston Globe analysis that found that Trump talks at a fourth grade level. Even more, Trump ended his year of media domination by receiving PolitiFact's 2015 Lie of the Year award for the long catalog of erroneous statements that he made and that he often stood by, even after they were shown to be wrong. It's amazing that a whopping 76% of the statements by Trump that PolitiFact checked were judged to be mostly false, or pants on fire. By comparison, 71% of Bernie Sanders statements were rated half true, mostly true, or true. But the real menace of Trump's presidential campaign, though, isn't that he's a pathological liar with 39% of the Republican vote. It's that he, along with Fox News, works to actively undercut the perceived trustworthiness of facts, expertise, and science. For example, in response to receiving PolitiFact's dubious award for lying, he responded on Fox News by attempting to delegitimize the organization, calling them a totally left-wing group.
This question was asked of all the Republican voters in the PPP poll. Quote, "Do you think Barack Obama is a Christian or a Muslim, or are you not sure? 14% of Republican voters say President Obama is a Christian. 14%. The percentage of Republican voters who say he's a Muslim, 54%. And the percentage of Republican voters who say they aren't sure whether or not President Obama is a Christian, that is 32%. President Obama is, in fact, a Christian. But 86% of the Republican electorate either doesn't believe that or they're not sure. Similarly, this was question 28 in the new poll. Dear Republican voters, do you think Barack Obama, President of the United States, was born in the United States? The proportion of Republican voters who say yes, President Obama was born in the U.S. is 29%. The proportion who say no, he wasn't born in the United States is 44%. And another 26% aren't sure. In fact, President Obama was born in the United States. Do I have to say it? But fully 70% of the Republican electorate just doesn't believe that, or they say they don't know. Only 29% of Republican voters think that President Obama is actually president. Do you guys think that Ted Cruz was born in the United States? Even though only 29% of Americans think that President Obama was born in the U.S., 40% of them think that Ted Cruz was. Ted Cruz was not born in the United States. He was born in Canada.
Facts, logic, reasoning, it escapes this entire group of people. So, how do we solve the growing scourge of anti-intellectualism in America? There's no easy answer. No amount of evidence-based argumentation will ever convince them that their views are factually incorrect or morally misguided. In a 2010 study by the Boston Globe, found that presenting political partisans with contradictory facts only solidifies their erroneous convictions. So, Bernie Sanders has said, if he doesn't win as president, he's going to hold together the coalition that has formed around him. And he's going to continue to work for the very progressive things that he believes in and that he has always believed in. So, he's got this entire network put together. And if he wins the presidency, then he gets to do these progressive things as president. But if he does not win the presidency, well, he still has this group and he's still going to work for these things that he believes in and has always believed in. Now, Donald Trump. If Donald Trump wins the presidency, he just can't wait to be president. But if he does not win the presidency, Trump has been pretty clear about how he feels about not winning the presidency.
If I don't win, I will consider this, and I mean this, a total and complete waste of time.
Dark money and ignorance go hand in hand. And I think I couldn't make it more clear. The two sides of the coin that you have in this election. It really looks like it's going to come down to Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders.
At least Bernie is getting some action. He gets much smaller crowds than me. But at least Bernie gets some action, right? Oh, would I love to run against Bernie. I would. Oh. That would be a dream come true. But actually, I must say, I have my mind set on Hillary.
Oh, Mr. Trump, you have no idea what's coming for you. And I cannot wait to watch you win this election because polls show that if it's you v. Bernie, you are not going to win. But this story is still being written at this very moment. Dark money, ignorance, hand in hand. But you know what? There's still more of us than there are of them. Ha! Let's go.
Tonight, I will address the crisis in Flint first and in depth. To begin, I'd like to address the people of Flint. Your families face a crisis you did not create and could not have prevented. I want to speak directly, honestly, and sincerely to let you know we are praying for you, we are working hard for you, and we are absolutely committed to taking the right steps to effectively solve this crisis. To you, the people of Flint, I say tonight, as I have before, I am sorry and I will fix it. No citizen of this great state should endure this kind of catastrophe. Government failed you, federal, state, and local leaders, by breaking the trust you placed in us. I'm sorry most of all that I let you down. You deserve better. You deserve accountability. You deserve to know that the buck stops here with me.
Austerity. It seems to be the answer for everything. Just ask any Republican. There's no problem that can't be solved by cuts. If you want to stimulate business, just cut taxes on the wealthy. If you have a budget crisis brought on by those tax cuts, then just cut social programs. Food assistance, housing assistance, the CHIP program, which is the Children's Health Insurance Program. Now, wait. We're cutting services on the poor in favor of tax cuts for the wealthy. It seems to me that the wealthy can afford it and that the poor cannot. Maybe we should not cut taxes on the wealthy. To which people respond, what am I, a communist? A socialist? If we don't cut taxes on the wealthy, who will create jobs? The jobs that those poor folks need if we don't cut taxes on the wealthy. Well, in reality, the vast majority of jobs are created by working people who also happen to be business owners, not the wealthy. That's what a commie would say. Listen, austerity does not work. It has never worked, and it will never work. But that's not the point. Austerity is not supposed to solve a problem. Well, It's not supposed to solve a problem for working people. It does, however, solve a problem for the opulent. Folks whose opulence makes them insecure. Austerity always exacts a heavy price, and it's always the working people who will foot the bill. It does, however, solve the problem of social mobility, and that has always been the goal. Michigan State has had for decades what is referred to as an emergency manager law, and here's how it's supposed to work. When a city goes into crisis, the governor appoints a mediator of sorts, someone nonpartisan, an outsider to help solve the crisis. The original Emergency Manager Act was called Public Act 72. Public Act 72 gave power to appointed officials, but it did not grant them sweeping powers. And they were to some degree still answerable to the population at large. Still, after Governor Rick Snyder was elected, Public Act 4 was put into law. It gave the emergency manager sweeping powers and it made them answerable only to the governor. So we're killing democracy here. The Republican governor, it was a very undemocratic law that makes him essentially a dictator. A crowd of people fought to have Public Act 4 overturned and they signed a petition. 203,000 people signed the petition, which is way more than the 161,000 signatures that were needed. Yet the validity of the law was challenged because of the size of the font. The State Board of Canvassers was deadlocked over the validity. The law stated that petitions had to be in a 14-point font. So clearly, the 203,000 people who signed it simply read the language and signed it because they agreed with the law. Clearly, they didn't mean to sign it because, as it says, it was not in a 14-point font. So, democracy is once again thwarted by the Republicans. Public Act 4 was eventually repealed. And then in late 2012, on a party line vote, Republicans rushed through a sweeping new emergency manager law, once again undermining what the people want and undermining democracy. Then the payoff for Republicans came. In April 2014, while the city of Flint was under the direction of an emergency manager, the city began drawing water from the Flint River. Now, it's not unheard of for cities to do this. They do it all the time. But first, if you're going to draw that water, you have to treat it so that it's clean, it's safe, and it doesn't corrode the pipes. They drew it from the Flint River rather than from Detroit because they said that the water coming from Detroit was way too costly. Immediately, residents noticed a funky odor, color, and taste. The untreated water was causing the 75-year-old iron pipes to break down, causing lead to leach into the water supply. Engineers then responded by jacking up the chlorine levels, which led to a dangerous toxicity. GM, the automaker, then noticed that the water was corroding engine parts and immediately quit using it. Mark Edwards, a professor, drove from Virginia Tech to test the water and found that the water had 900 times the recommended EPA limit of lead particles. Residents believed the city officials knew about the problem after 1 month. Immediately they knew about it. However, even as late as February 2015, officials were telling the residents that there was no threat and to relax. The residents would deal with the poisoned water for 20 months before officials would finally acknowledge the problem. Now, water is being trucked in and residents are being given filters, but it's not enough. The emergency manager was fired in this case, but so what? This can be laid squarely at the feet of the Republican governor, Rick Snyder, who still has a job, although he should be in jail. So where are we now? There are over 500 miles of corroded underground pipes that need to be replaced at an estimated cost of $1.5 billion. That estimate, though, could easily grow. What Governor Snyder has accomplished, though, is a terrorist's wet dream. By switching the water source and skipping critical safety steps, he has poisoned over 100,000 citizens in a major American city. And the effects of lead poisoning are permanent and irreversible. Some of the effects of lead poisoning are abdominal pain, sleep problems, headaches, irritability, fatigue, anemia, high blood pressure, kidney dysfunction. For children, though, it's worse because children are still developing. Lead is a neurotoxin. So for the children, lead has a half-life of about 30 days. But what it can do to your body can last forever. And so for children, they're looking at behavioral problems, low IQ, poor grades at school, problems hearing, and developmental delays. A high toxic dose, which is exactly what we're looking at in this case, can lead to vomiting, muscle weakness, stumbling when walking, seizures, coma, and encephalopathy, which manifests itself as a coma, seizures, and skin lesions. If you ask a Republican why this is okay, they'll point out that Dane Walling, the mayor, during this time was a Democrat. Some on the city council were also Democrats. And they'll say clearly Democrats caused the problem. And you'll hear it there in that clip that I played at the beginning of this segment. He said, hey, local government failed you. Your local members, they all failed you. No, Rick Snyder, you failed them. You failed the people. You did this by yourself. Government did not fail. This was not a Democratic decision. You did this, and you did this by yourself. Local officials were stripped of their power and replaced by an emergency manager of the governor's choosing. A manager answerable only to the Republican governor. In November 2015, Karen Weaver replaced Dane Walling. Karen is Flint's first ever female mayor. So whether it's unions, elections, or local officials, Republicans do not believe in democracy, and the poor and working class will always pay the high price for Republican austerity. Austerity is a religion, which is to say that there is no evidence that backs it up. It has never worked and it will never work, but there are millions that believe in it. That is a religion. It remains to be seen what's going to happen in Flint, Michigan. The governor waited forever to ask for FEMA to come down and help because he didn't want to admit that he did this. He didn't want to admit that there was a problem. Now he's finally admitted that there's a problem because now it's made it in to the Democratic election for president. But Melvin, I thought you said that this was a terrorist attack. Think about that for a minute. Terrorism. If terrorists could find a way to interrupt or cut off the power grid, think of how much chaos that would cause. Or even worse, if they were able to poison the water supply in even one major American city, they could poison 100,000 people all at the same time. And that's what Governor Rick Snyder, Republican Governor Rick Snyder of Michigan, just did. I don't think our choice in the upcoming election, any of the upcoming elections, could be more clear than it is right now. If you elect Republicans, especially far-right Republicans, there will be austerity. And it will not be the wealthy that pay the price for that austerity. It'll be the same folks who always pay the same price. It will always be working people that pay a heavy price for Republican austerity. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being here on The Fire You Can't Put Out. You can download or stream the shows at OpenSkyArchive.com, our official home. It's KiwiStation.com. Like us on Facebook at Facebook.com/TFYCPO. You can listen on the go. Just download the Kiwi Station app at the iTunes Store or at the Google Play Store for Android users. The Open Sky Archive app is still available at both app stores. Individual episodes are available for download at the iTunes Store. Just search for The Fire You Can't Put Out. There you can also subscribe so that you never miss an episode. Questions, comments, hate mail, or just a general statement or inquiry. I said it. Republicans, terrorists. It's not a lot of daylight between you guys. You can email us here at tfycpo@gmail.com. We work hard to not only inform and entertain, but also to keep an open dialogue with our growing listener base. So feel free to reach out to us. And as always, thank you for listening. We are the fire you can't put out. And we will prevail, rejecting austerity, as I say at the end of every show. Rejecting austerity in favor of prosperity. Special thanks to Kevin for producing, and a big thanks to Kiwi Station putting us on and making us available 24/7, 365 around the world. This is Melvin signing off. And now that I have woken you up, good morning.